transportation industry, the banking industry. Everybody's trying to define their own standard, and the problem is you've got tremendous overlap. I guarantee you every one of these has to deal with address, as an example. You'd think address would be something that you could establish a global standard for. Well, the problem is even address is a very, very, very complex concept. And you've got international flavors of address, you've got, you know, regional flavors of address. So it becomes very challenging. So tackling this problem, not only Lockheed Martin, but the aerospace industry said we need to drive toward some common XML schema requirement. And you're going to see on these next two slides, or the next few slides here, three basic breakdowns of those schema requirements. You've got the foundational or structure, so things like XML and XML schema from W3C, those are absolutely foundational standards. Along with that, a global naming convention standard, 11179, which is international, and that is a key standard. And then the United Nations XML schema naming and design rules, which are part of the EBXML world. And then you've got this thing called the payload, or payload requirement. There's a whole host of standards out there. You know, the people in the, and I've got a slide that will talk about it shortly, but in the payload world, you've got the ResetaNet world, which primarily is electronics world. You've got the XBRL, which is the world's leading accounting firms. And you've got a whole host of other flavors of XML. UBL is trying to make get a start there, too. But I say the most important foundational piece for the payload is to establish a common set of basic data types. What is a text? What is an amount? What is a quantity? There's two gold nuggets in the the ISO 15000-5, which is the core components technical spec. There's two gold nuggets in that thing, namely the basic data type, amount, date, name, quantity, tables 8-1 and 8-3. Those are fundamental gold nuggets in the payload. If you don't establish common understanding of these gold nuggets, I guarantee you interoperability will never, never happen.
Ron,
yes.
As you switch slides, it would be good for people on the phone.
I'm sorry.
Give some indication.
I'm sorry. Good point. I just switched to the example payload standard slide. And so now these are examples of payload standards that are out there. You could throw UBL onto this list. You could put ResetaNet on the list. There's some areas that are more, you might say, redundant with each other. I put a wage that's more redundant with ResetaNet and UBL. But the healthcare world, all of your healthcare providers have an HL7. The insurance industry has Accord, and these are, you know, global insurance providers. Your global accounting firms have XBRL. And then in the world that I come from, where configuration management, as you're in an engineering design process and building and designing products and manufacturing those products, you need to manage configuration control of the changes of those products. The EIA 36 has an XML DTD, which is moving into a schema. So things like engineering changes. And then there's this additional layer after you get the foundational structure and then the payload. Then there's another layer called your infrastructure support. And for that, there's a need for a centralized registry repository so that across an entire industry, go to a single place, find out what the standard is for that industry. And then because there is no single XML schema that's globally adopted by everybody on the planet, whether you're government or industry or nonprofit, until that point in time, you need something that can transcend all of those different organizations, and that's what the intent of the UDF is. It basically helps provide an indexing mechanism that identifies the points of intersection across these various schema, as well as to improve data understandability. So what is this thing called the UDF, or Universal Data Element Framework? It's basically an instantiation of this 11179-5 standard. And if you look at that standard, all it really tells you to do is you must have object classes and you must have property terms for a given data element concept. It defines what a data element concept is. You have to have something called a property term combined with something called an object class. And it does not specify what those property terms should be, nor does it specify what the object terms should be. So this organization that I was the chair of back in the CALS Industry Steering Group days, it was an organization of industry working with government, primarily DOD. We developed this UDF concept. We adopted the 11179 naming convention. And UDF is basically an instantiation of that standard. It also, by the way, adopted out of the core components technical spec the same term, basic data types, if you will, that come directly out of EBXML's core components. So these are your fundamental data types, amount, date, time, identifier, and so forth. These are the foundation building blocks that will never achieve interoperability if the entire planet doesn't adopt these. And then, if you look at a taxonomy or ontology of basic objects applicable to any enterprise on the planet, what are those basic objects? And that's what the UDF object list is intended to be. When you understand the definitions in UDF, they are mutually exclusive. And so you have any enterprise on the planet, there's data about the enterprise. Any enterprise on the planet, there's data about their product. Even if you're a service organization. A service is simply a subtype of product. You have assets, you have persons. The UDF naming convention then also takes advantage of qualifiers. So against this list, you've got an ontology, if you will, of all of these basic properties and then subtypes of those properties. For instance, a date could have a delivery date. And it could be a scheduled delivery date. That's a subtype of date. And so there's an ontology of all kinds of different types of dates. But standing alone, that date doesn't mean anything until you associate it with an object. And so you then, because UDF basically enforces a rule that the order of the words must be according to this 11179, and then following the rules of English, a given word that's added to a string must precede, when it's a qualifier, must precede the word it's modified. So that when you end up with a UDF name that follows those rules, you have something that's grammatically correct. It follows the rules of English. And so an engineering design process cost amount, you must use one of these words and you must use one of those words. And then you end up with something that's grammatically correct. And when you enforce the rule of UDF, you'll end up with something that technically would not even require a definition. Because it should be intuitively obvious to anybody that's working in that domain.
Okay.
So if you take those different standards and put together an architecture or a standard stack, you got these basic schema structure standards as listed here, XML, XML schema from W3C, 11179-5, EDXML core components technical spec, UN naming and design rules. And then you got in this middle layer all of these various flavors of XML schema along with each industry has to either take a subset of those schema or extend them. In the case of X-12, for instance, our aerospace industry said, we've got an implementation convention of X-12, and it's a subset. We don't need the entire X-12 for a purchase order. We'd say we've got a subset. But in the case of for instance, OAGIS is one of those 70% or 80%. It's not sufficient for our industry, so we have to extend it. So there's going to be organization-specific extensions for subsets of these standards. And then on top of that, you've got RDF and OWL, and those help do metadata alignment between different ontologies. But when you get to the semantics of the payload, that's where the UDF fits in. I indicated that those basic data types were matched up directly with EBXML core components. The words in yellow on the left are directly out of EBXML core components technical spec table 8-3, and the words in green then are the UDEF names, and you can see it's going through that list that they're one and the same. These are the basic objects in UDEF, and these give context. To a given property string, like scheduled delivery date, it could be a product scheduled delivery date, it could be a document scheduled delivery date, it could be a baby's scheduled delivery date. So you have to put an object into these things before you can know what those, you know, basic building blocks of properties are relating to. So these UDEF objects are, you take things like a purchase order. So a purchase order is a document. Well, if you want to force a computer to understand that a purchase order is a document, and then put document in the name, then you're forcing all documents to use the word document in the name. So purchase order document. Yeah, we need you closer to the door. Okay. You need to put the word purchase order or the word document into a purchase order document's name. And that way you've got, within the UDEF, you're forcing everything to the same level of abstraction, which then forces you to use words, or you end up with a UDEF name that's substantially longer than the normal in most systems. You're not forcing anybody to use the UDEF name. The key to the UDEF, though, is basically to come up with the ID, the Dewey Decimal Number, if you will, that has structure and intelligence within that ID. And so if you go to the slide on UDEF ontologies, there are, in fact, 16 of those UDEF objects. Each of them has its own ontology, which is a subtyping of all of those objects. So what's shown here in the example is that there is an object called document, and a subtype of document is an order document. And a subtype of order document could be a work order, a change order, a technical order, or a purchase order. And there are others, by the way. So the UDEF has an ontology of subtyping of each of the 16 objects. It also has an ontology of subtyping of each of the 18 property words that come from EBXML core components technical spec. And so when you end up using this approach and then assigning an indexing ID, if you will, this D.T.2_33.4 is the same as purchase order document type code. And no matter what language you want to have, if that concept exists in Korean or Japanese or Spanish or whatever, Russian, whatever that concept is, independently, organizations would map to the UDEF and assign that concept, this ID. That ID then is computer sensible. The computer knows how to interpret that, and basically it becomes your canonical model for any kind of business transaction or even in our industry, getting the things like warfighters putting weapons on target with a certain timing. So these UDEF structured IDs are the key. Here you've got two different product data management systems, PDM system A and B. You've got six different standards. The concept is that I've got this thing called a product ID, but with the UDEF I can also add the fact that it's the manufacturer's assigned ID as opposed to the retailer's assigned ID, as opposed to someone else's assigned ID. You can capture that additional metadata if you choose with the UDEF. And so, in essence, you get the 2N instead of the N squared problem. Here's an example, then, of applying the UDEF with XML. Taking two instances, one from XCDL, two from two different industries. One XCDL, which is used in our industry by Exostar, which is a host that manages a lot of our transactions. By taking those data elements and assigning a UDEF ID, and then doing similarly to OAGIS 7.2, and then because they share now common IDs but have independently been mapped, and those IDs could be made available in an API to both systems, and then sending these two files that have these IDs added and sending them to that URL that's listed at the bottom of the slide, you can in fact have a gap analysis report sent back to you in less than a second. And so when two different trading partners are trying to figure out where do we have semantic alignment between what one company uses versus another company, and this is realistic, our industry uses a lot of XCDL, a lot of other industries, you know, the automotive and many others use OAGIS, others use RosettaNet. If they independently map their elements like this for a typical purchase order and give UDF IDs, then the semantics of alignment can be done almost immediately by going to that URL. It'll spit back a gap analysis report similar to this. Basically, two different systems independently map their elements, assign those IDs, and then the report that comes back basically says, for this on one system has this ID, that's what it is in the other system. And so that's there. Although it's not, you know, that URL is not what I call an industrial strength capability, because but it was demonstrated for a proof of concept at EIDX meetings in May of 2003. As well as August 2003. So to actually implement the UDEF basically requires a global UDEF registry. The aerospace industry is working with the Association for Enterprise Integration, which is under the National Defense Industrial Association. NDIA, working with AIA, aerospace industry, that's the Boeing's, Lockheed's, Raytheon's, Northrop Grumman's. We're trying to define a global nonprofit to actually manage the UDEF tree structures. I've got, at the end of conclusion here, I'll briefly show, unfortunately the folks on the phone won't be able to see it, but briefly show examples of the tree structures for several of those different taxonomies. But basically, to host them that and manage the extensions, additional extensions to the UDEF. Within a given enterprise, and Lockheed Martin or the Department of Defense or whomever, that have lots and lots of back office systems. We heard, for instance, the logistics folks in DOD have some 700 back office systems that they currently have to deal with. They need something to help them manage their metadata. And so you've got lots and lots of different schemas there. You've got lots and lots of, you know, you have the need for a mapping matrix, and basically some mapping, you know, some centralized registry that was totally keyed on the UDEF IDs and then matrices like what the XREF is. So here's what it is in this system, here's what it is in this system, here's what it is in this standard, and this standard, and this standard, and oh, by the way, it's keyed by a UDEF ID. That UDEF ID then gets exposed in an API so that when you want to integrate two systems that all have this UDEF ID in the API, you now take advantage of this online UDEF gap analysis report. Okay, you heard earlier about RFID, or several of you did. In that session, you also heard about the, you know, the DoD's unique ID. I'm going to use this simply as an example of how the UDEF can be applied to DoD's unique ID requirement. Basically, DoD has this requirement. You have a globally unique ID that is comprised of three elements. It requires the enterprise ID, the part number, and the serial number, and that string of three elements are concatenated into a single field called unique ID. And this slide on the UID and the supply chain summarizes how that's going to work. It says that at the system level, in other words, this example is a Jeep, at the system level, you got a system unique ID. The various sub-assemblies within that also have their unique IDs, even down to the parts, you know, the component parts like a bolt. And so each of those then has to feed into the total system, but each of them has their unique IDs. If you apply the UDEF, you can now bring additional metadata to it. Currently, the DoD is only asking for enterprise ID. But if they want to differentiate, well, it's the manufacturer's enterprise ID. And, oh, by the way, it's the one that was assigned by Dunn, as opposed to the one assigned by the Defense Logistics Agency. You heard about the CAGE code. As opposed to the one assigned by EAN-UCC, which is the retail industry, then you can add that additional metadata in there by what the UDEF offers, or you can also just say it enterprise ID. So the UDEF brings to the table the opportunity to add additional metadata if you choose. And with it, if you choose the additional metadata, then you also get the ID that goes with that. So, for instance, the top example here shows manufacturer enterprise Dunn assigned identifier AH.3_5.35.8. Only one person in a given business ever has to deal with that number, and that's the person that does the initial mapping. After that, it's the computers that then take advantage of those IDs, which are like IP addresses. Computers know how to deal with number dot number dot number. That's what your internet IP address is, number dot number dot number. Computers know how to deal with that quite rapidly. It also allows you the ability to allow you to know that it's a weapon system as opposed to a part. So that additional metadata is something that you can bring to the table. But if you don't want it, that's fine. It's just a part ID or a part ID, you know, product ID, product ID. So the flexibility is there to bring additional metadata and the associated UDEF IDs. And this is something that is, you know, gaining some attention within the Department of Defense. I worked with, representing Lockheed Martin, with Raytheon and Northrop Grumman, and we actually did a mapping against five different DoD documents. The different DoD documents were an actual procurement of a Raytheon spare part, happened to be a cable harness. But we analyzed all of the fields in those five procurement documents against, in other words, the request for quote, the response to the request for quote, the purchase order, the DD-250, which is your receiving an inspection report, and the invoice. And it's within the DD-250 where those UID requirements are going to be required, in other words, the unique ID. So we mapped them all against that, and basically we've got a
a large, large spreadsheet that captures that. And this is only a snippet of it.
But when you look at comparing the UDEF names versus the system names, in other words, in that DoD document, you've got this thing called DPAS priority. And if you map it into OAGIS XML with this XML path name, it's a purchase order header priority. But if you assign it a UDEF name, it comes out to purchase order document government assigned priority code, which is a much more descriptive name of what that is compared to DPAS priority or what this is. And the bottom line is, it makes it much more understandable to somebody that doesn't know what a DPAS priority is. The reason I use this example, if you take the UDEF approach, which forces you into common levels of abstraction, you end up with names that are much longer than you've normally used. DPAS priority is a whole lot smaller name than purchase order document government signed priority code. But I can give that to someone who's never seen a DPAS priority before, and they can begin to get an understanding of what that is. And you don't need to have that subject matter expert around who understands that system. If they've done this once, and I'll let a computer say that d.t.2_1.4.31.4 is equal to the name, you can now let, you know, other people potentially get involved in building or modifying a system or using a system. And so for understandability, UDEF forces you into a 11179 naming approach. It forces you into a common level of abstraction based on these high-level objects as well as that set of EBXML core component terms. Recently, the UDEF has shown up in the press in the fact that Network World, one of their editors or a consultant and columnist, a guy named Mark Gibbs, he wrote an article, and I take this quote directly out of that article, and you can go to the website and read the whole article. The need for UDEF is massive and inescapable, and the bigger the enterprise, the greater the need. And basically what he's saying is, because bigger enterprises have a whole lot of back office systems they have to tie together, and because they have typically a much, much larger supply chain that they have to deal with, the bigger the enterprise, the greater the need for UDEF. Our industry has a set of standards that we're looking at, and I want to put UDEF into a proper context. Because we don't have the global registry stood up yet, we can't put it into the adopted category, but our industry is definitely considering it a candidate along with these standards that are showing up here. And this set of standards, then, we're either monitoring, exploring use, or participating directly in the development. UDEF is one of the categories for the direct participation. I'll show this slide again tomorrow when I talk about what our industry is doing with the standards. If you want additional information on 11179, you can download it from that site there. If you want to see an article how the UDEF directly relates to the EBXML core components, you can go online and read that article. And if you want to get more information about the UDEF in depth, you can go to udef.org, or you can give me a call or send me an email. And that concludes my presentation.
Hey,
we can't go downstairs.
I'll give it my best.
Please try and stay as close to the phone as possible. I dial in to check, and unless you're standing on top of the thing, you should drop out, which must drive the people on the phone crazy.
My name is Dwayne Nickel from Adobe Systems. I'm also here wearing a hat from the United Nations as well. I'm the vice chair of UNCFACT and was one of the original architects of VBXML, where I met John Bosack and others, and have worked on the web services architecture. So this kind of conversation is something that's come up repeatedly for me, and it's kind of the world I've lived in over the last years. For those of you on the phone, we're starting with the presentation, UNCFRAC Core Components, Semantic Interoperability of Data Elements and Context Framework, and going to slide two. I just put in these slides for a brief introduction, the scope of the United Nations work. And I'm not going to run through it, but one of the key points I wanted to do is set the context for why the UN's doing this, but also explain that the UN's really focused on this on a global effort. One of the things that's been really obvious to us in the past is that a lot of efforts that have looked at this have looked at it from a common perspective of everybody speaking one language. When you start to look at qualifying terms, etc., etc., when you start to look at languages that have the qualifiers at the end, like Japanese, it's a lot different, and the semantics get a lot more confusing and hard to follow. The whole notion and idea that everybody thinks in this dimension going from left to right is just not applicable on a global basis. So that's where the UN takes on a slightly different look at the problem, where we actually have really examined what needs to be done. We have missions that are primarily related to trade facilitation and electronic business, and this is on slide three. We have a focus, and it is to do with national as well as international areas of development. There's a whole gamut of reasons of why we need this. The UN is primarily involved from a standpoint that we have an obligation, a mission to make the world a better place. Of the six bodies of the United Nations, the Economic and Security Council, or sorry, the Economic and Social Council, is the only council that really deals with stuff before it happens. The rest of them deal with stuff after it happens. And gradually the focus of work has really started to look more at, let's not clean stuff up after it happens, but let's look at the cause of some of the problems in the world today. And increasingly, the consensus is that economics has affected a lot of the globe in the last century. So that's what my life's work is all about now, and what we're dealing with, and now we can kind of get into the core components area. So the agenda is very simple. I'll keep this introduction to the agenda short so we can stay on schedule and get everyone to go on to slide six. Core components were developed in EBXML to address a very fundamental aspect of standards development. The reason just about every other standards has failed in this area in the past is because they were developed from this mindset of, let's develop a standard for the whole world to use, and my one standard will work for the whole world. Well, if more than two people do that, or two or more people do that, there becomes a problem with it. So the approach in EBXML was to not define what a purchase order should look like for once and all. Let's define the building blocks that people can use to make their own purchase orders, or building blocks where people can take what the purchase orders they have are and look back at our kind of building blocks to kind of semantically reconcile them with each other. So it's kind of a combination of the approaches you've heard about from John and from Ron with the UBL functionality of taking these building blocks and building something out of it through modeling, and also from the approach of semantic reconciliation. Each core component is really about a real-world concept, and the example that Ron used, Dave, just happens to be the example I used too, so this is going to be very good. They're designed to be reused globally, and that's really a key issue, because having the notion that only English-speaking people will look at these has a very flawed methodology at one point. These are design time artifacts, and they are meant to be built into XML schemas, UNE docs, etc. It says codeless here. Codeless are really supporting a core component or supporting the real-world instantiation of it, which is called a business information entity. Codeless are the value domain of that core component. When I talk about business information entities, or BIEs, these are specializations of these things called core components. Core components are abstracted to a very high level where you would probably not gather a lot of meaning out of them. Like Ron's presentation, if you just have date, date doesn't really mean a lot semantically. It is a thing. It is a type of thing that we kind of agree on what it is conceptually. But until it gets those qualifier terms in front of it, like purchase order date or being birth year date or something that gives it more context, it doesn't really become specialized enough to use. The relationship between core components and UBL is that the core components are kind of about the methodology and those high-level building blocks, where the UBL is really one set of a specialization of those things that can be used in business today. Now, I'm using core components here to cover a gamut of terms, but I'm going to get more specialized from here on in. We're now on slide 7. The core components by themselves get constrained by something called context. And the context methodology is inherent in the UMC FACT and ISO core component standard. The context framework involves a modeling exercise where you look at where the things you are modeling and designing will be used, and you apply these constraints based on a set of contextual categories. There are currently 8 that are recognized. My gut feeling is there may be more later as we implement this more often. The idea may be that if there's a core component of date and we're using it in the EU, it may take on a constraint that it takes on the European date formatting, which is different than the North American date formatting. Together, a set of 8 contexts make up a special business context or a specific business context. And this applied to the core component with the constraint. Hello? That's an interesting comment. First time this has ever had a physical reaction of somebody. The business information entity at this point is still syntax neutral, which is an actual incorrect term. I like to refer to it as syntax independent, which means it's not bound to be represented in any one syntax. And this is still at modeling time. The final context category that should be applied is one of system capability. If the system capability is XML, you may then probably bind these to an XML schema, which can constrain instances of the XML. So a lot of this is a modeling and design time effort. The actual aggregation of these into data messages looks a lot like a toy I played with when I was little called Lego. And it was a great thing. You had this set of blocks you can make a whole bunch of different toys out of. And this looks amazingly simple and childlike when you look at it, except for this green guy at the bottom called context. And this is in slide 8, and there's a lot of animation, so you just have to keep clicking. The relationship of how this affects the actual semantics is actually a little bit more uglier than it appears at the first glance. When you look at something like first name, we could sit in this room and we could come up with a unified definition of what a first name is. We would all agree to it, walk out of this room and thinking we've done a great job. But if somebody used it hierarchically in a container of invoice as a document, party, type equals seller party, first name, that's a little bit different semantically from party, buyer party, first name. So even though this thing itself isn't modified over here, its hierarchical containership actually modifies the semantics slightly. And the reality is when you're designing the stuff on the left, like they do in the core components, and trying to bring this up, you have absolutely no control on how people will use it. You have this idea of how you think people should use your work, your standards, but people will always use it for something other than it was meant for, or other than you intended to it. Which leads us to the developer's question, what did you do with my thing that made it break? There's some base things we need in core components. One is the unique identifier. Something like the UDEF has really driven that point home. We use the UUID DCE 128-bit algorithmic format for that, which is, after a lot of debate on the XML dev and other lists over the last years, has generally been accepted to be reasonably assured unique. Data dictionary name, object class term, property term, representation term, and these are all basically from the ISO IEC 11179 works, and the data type as well. The metadata from the registry also provides additional information if you use core components in conjunction with a metadata registry repository, which was the thing Ron was talking about as well. And this gets into the concept of a metadata owner, the versioning of it, the status of it, is it ready for use now, the home registry URI to support federations, names, different people call the same thing different names, and this is a great way to reconcile your data dictionary and my data dictionary. The associations between these things, classifications, and syntax information. Keeping in mind our scope is global, we have to have multilingual support for all of these things, so it gets very, very complex. The only thing that is guaranteed to be always in the primary key in English is the data dictionary name if you're using CCTS, because they agreed to use the Oxford Dictionary, which is the Queen's English, unlike my Canadian English. So we're now going on to slide 11. What problems does core components solve? Well, the problem really is the proliferation of standards, XML-based and other. And I've got some in here who probably shouldn't be in here, but they were lumped in here. This is a slide from another presenter that I reused. A lot of the problems that this gives us also is that within defining the same data element over and over from scratch, you also get inconsistent representations, inconsistent masking, inconsistent data types, because the applications that consume instances of the data have been built in technological isolation from one another. There's often data typing problems that programmers have to look at that the developers of a actual language never looked at before. Somebody will create an element and just treat it as a string. Well, we might want to treat it as something nice, something different, like an integer. There was one in the basic core components, or EBXML core components version 1. It was called indicator. Programmers are more used to something like a Boolean. So we have to make that translation from the interchange format to the part that's used within our applications, and that becomes quite a big problem. The solution of using a data dictionary means you're not really challenging this problem at a document by document or transaction by transaction level. You can actually break the big problem down into a bunch of smaller problems, which is a very nice thing. If you look at each one of the data elements separately, it also enables you to look at your whole architecture differently. Whether before you're looking at a document and the document is tied somehow to a business process, now you're looking at a document is really a view to a collection of data instances and nothing more. It's the data instances that are aggregated that make the actual data transaction. Going on to slide 14, the UNC CFAC core components vision was to create a way that we can take a lot of the existing standards and we could actually reconcile them. Now I've got UBL drawn on the left-hand side of this, and this is only to illustrate one point, which is that UBL has actually jumped up the ladder quite a bit. UBL was actually founded after the core components was founded, when John and myself and some others actually realized to our dismay that EBXML, in delivering everything that it delivered, did not deliver a set of usable documents, and realized that without those, there would probably not be a large degree of adoption. John had the foresight to start this project by himself, and they've gone light years ahead of where existing thinking has gone into things like document engineering or developing standards for data transactions. We're now going on to slide 16. So who's working on this these standards today? Well, EBXML did the work until 2001. It started in 1999. In May 2001, the work continued within UNCFAC under the TMG and ATG. UNCFAC stands for the Center for Facilitation of Commerce and Trade. TMG is the Techniques and Methodologies Group, and the ATG is the Advanced Applied Technologies Group. The UBL work started in 2001 to actually build a set of BIEs conformant with the principles and methodologies of CCTS. And in my own opinion, I've been remarkably successful at driving that forward. We're now going on to slide 18. There's a process within the CCTS methodology of core component discovery, and this is something that would likely be a good exercise for anybody who has an existing data dictionary to do. If you do it right, you'll probably find that your existing standard of XML or EDI should have around between maybe 100 to 500 data elements in it, which can probably be categorized into one of those 18 categories Ron was talking about. If you do this wrong, you'll probably end up with 4,000 to 5,000 different data elements, which would be largely unmanageable. So I've seen instances of both of these happen in the real world. The idea is that business documents are part of a business process. The business process and the role of where the document is getting sent to and from are all part of the contextual classification of how that data develops its semantics. Within these, you can boil out, using the core components methodology, a set of common data elements through the discovery process, and the idea is that you would use these to build a core component library. The real work to do this at a higher level should probably be done under the auspices of the UNC FACT or another organization such as this. The idea is that when you then use these in practice, you can look at the context of these, and you can then start to get down to your business information entities. Once you've abstracted it up to these high-level things, get down back to how you're using them on these specific transactions. The steps are very clearly spelled out in the CCTS step, and this is on slide 19. And there's a number of different activities. This is largely a manual activity. It's largely like the Rose Unified process, where you actually look at all the aspects of something before you try and define it. And it's largely common sense, but there's some actual steps that were needed to, you know, be constraintive enough so two different parties doing the same thing would end up with roughly the same idea of what they should have at the end. To use them at design time, when you design a new business process, so if UBL decided they wanted to focus on a process of foo as a process may have 10 new messages on it. So these messages would really, at a high level, you would look at what was needed to be aggregated into these business messages or transactions. The second step would be to identify the core components you would like to use on these things. You would then look at the context of how you were going to deploy these and end up with some contextually specific data elements that you could aggregate together. These can be expressed in a number of ways. You can do this all in UML. You could do it on napkins, writing the words in your native language, or you could actually do it in XML and write a program that does it for you, which I've actually done, and I will demonstrate to you on this laptop. I'm trying to get through this faster than I normally would here. We're now on to slide 22 for those on the phone. The CCTS status is that version 2.01 has been completed and it's gone through the CFACT open development process. It's been submitted to the International Standards Organization for Fast Tracking as an ISO standard, and that it is under the standards track of 15,000. The UNC FACT ATG has some CC or core components naming and design rules out for review. And as a caveat, I'm going to explain about those in a second. The core components technical specification is getting a few reference implementations and proofs of concept. I've mentioned some governments here. There's some other companies that have done it. I've heard of, I think, two or three just in the last month. UBL certainly is going to be instrumental in spreading this further. Which I put down. Some of the caveats about the CCTS status that you need to be aware of. There is two different sets of naming and design rules that exist, and this needs resolution. One exists as an official ATG proposal for core components naming and design rules. The other is the UBL naming and design rules. They have a slight conflict in them which needs to be resolved. The work to resolve it is underway. The MOU meeting last week, there were some steps taken to reconcile that. There's no serialization of core components from EBXML or any other registry repository or any other application formally defined. So if I have core components somewhere and you send an electronic request to get them, there's no standard about how I send them to you, what they are when you get them, whether I put a scribblings on a napkin and put it in an envelope and mail it back, or whether it actually comes back conforming to an XML theme or it's a JPEG rendition of a UML diagram or what it is. So there's a lot of different choices. This has to be resolved. And the context framework itself is not complete. Without the context framework, the semantics are impossible to define. We're now on to slide 24. The using core components today, and this is just a small demonstration of some work that was done. A lot of this is non-normative. It takes the base standards and adopts and embraces the methodology, but does some pretty cool things. The Government of Canada has something called CIPSN, which is the Canada Public Safety Information Network, and within that they have something called the Integrated Justice Initiative. And they went through this exercise of taking everybody in the justice realm and saying, let's develop a common data model for all the elements, or for all the instance data we're going to pass back and forth. They developed a IGI data dictionary, Gold, which had 353 different data elements in it. These are really business information entities in the true core components technical babble. But from the Canadian CIPSN IJI initiative, they are their core component because they don't intend to share this data outside of the realm of justice and security. The Government of Canada placed those through contracts with some companies into an EBXML register repository, and that's up and running today. I can give you the URL at the end of that. The data model they did is an XML rendition of the UML model for expressing core components. And it's augmented with some stuff that is in the registry that was on the left-hand side of the screen, so that when you request one of these things out and you're going to work with it, you get not only the core component stuff, but also those additional details about the owner of it and the other things you may need to work with it without having access to a registry. And we believe this was a very important aspect to look at. We don't want to do anything to core components that makes it dependent on always having a registry. And we use them in the Government of Canada for building transactions. So all the new transactions that the CIPSN group is going to work on for IGI should use these new data elements. And this way, if somebody comes up and says, I'm going to build a form, and they're going to take a person's full name on the form, they're not going to develop yet another format for somebody to render their name in. The work is currently entering phase four. This is a role, a model from some of the work they actually did. In Canada, we have two official languages. As you go through what's called a case, which is synonymous with a business process, you have a number of different roles involved. A crime happens somewhere, or an event happens. A police officer at the scene would look at somebody and call them a witness. Later on, when this gets assigned as a case, and an investigator is assigned to the case, he may look at the same person and call them a suspect. This is on slide 25 now. If he gets charged, the judge would then call him a defendant. If he gets convicted, the corrections would call him an inmate or a criminal, and if he's good in jail, the National Parole Board would then call him a parolee, and afterwards he would probably get out and join a standards body and work with court opponents. We also have the same thing happening in French on the right side of the screen. I don't know if they'd let you off early if you presented this stuff in jail or not in Canada. The demo scenario that we did for the Canadian government was to take these data elements, and the example we used was year for one of them, and apply their context usage, and we had built a context declaration schema which allows you to aggregate all eight of these context qualifiers and actual instance values onto these, and it constrained the business information entities in a syntax-independent way. An example of this would be year becomes the suspect birth year as part of that police investigation. And then it would be bound to syntax based on the system's capabilities context at the bottom, and then expressed as an XML schema fragment, and we actually put it into PDF e-forms because I work for Adobe and that's what we're very good at. We're now on to slide 27, and there's some animation on here. The demo scenario that I'm going to show you is that I've got a register repository running on my laptop, which has some of the data elements in it. It's only got three in for demonstration purposes. The transaction assembly document, the transaction that the process designers are going to develop as part of a new transaction, is going to actually reference these core data elements. When they're finished designing their process and their transactions, they would then look at the context of deployment. Where is this going to be deployed? Now, in reality, for this to be automated, you probably present somebody with a screen that says, what geographical area are you going to deploy it in? You pick Quebec. So then, you know, something would modify inside so that it would be expressed in French, Quebec being the French-speaking region of Canada. These two things, the context declaration and the transaction assembly doc, would be fed into the assembler utility. This thing will make calls to the registry, and it will spit out an XML schema. And then we used a subsequent process to slurp this into the forms designer and build a forms template, and that can be placed into the registry. And that can also be bound back into an actual business process. So for those of you not on the phone, I'm going to apologize right now because I'm going to jump into the demonstration. And sorry, I just have to start up the window here. So what you're looking at here is the actual registry running on my laptop. And much like the Windows Explorer, it allows you to browse and drill down and look at the classification nodes in a registry. So these are like folders on your Windows machine. I could click on this folder and open it up. This is the materials for the March demo. I have some assembly documents that were built. I have a set of context, and I have a set of data elements. The data elements themselves are based on the XML format for the actual core components UML models. And this contains basically four main sections to them, the last of which is kind of an optional one. The first one is the core information that's assigned about the actual core component, and the identifiers is the second section. The identifiers contains many different identifiers, but the only real one that matters is this top-level one, which is the UUID in the 128-bit format. The identifiers here are really interesting because the SIPSIN data dictionary had element identifiers that were just four digits, which wasn't really meaningful to anybody else, but meaningful to them. So we built it in a way that you could actually have different identifier types put on here and reconcile them. So this would be a core component kind of with the qualifier terms or the UDEF format compliant data dictionary name here with a dot concatenated set of words. They also had, from an entity model, they had an entity name that they wanted to use as a type of identifier, which was really extraneous to the other ones. The idea is that this is extensible. If other people, if you have these things in a register repository, like the UDEF register repository, and somebody has an existing language and says, I want to reconcile my thing with this thing at a high level, they have that mechanism to do it. The second is a set of properties, and these are inferred by the organization who owns this data element. And this can contain multiple assertions. And then there's representation. So the representations are really schema fragments. And each schema fragment is for a different context UUID, and you can see the UUID of the context here. This is synonymous back in the registry with the context. If I'm drilling down, I can come down and say I'm going in the realm of justice and public safety and in the French language and look at a set of contexts. This one has three for demonstration purposes. The idea is that you aggregate the set of eight context statements together and assign them one UUID, which is kind of a key that is the key to unlock the specific business information entity from that core component, or reference it more accurately. And this is the point when people who see this, their eyes usually glaze over because I've not explained enough background on this stuff, but there's just simply no way you can do it in 45 minutes. What I will do, though, is just run the demonstration so you can see the different results at the bottom. We're going to use this transaction assembly doc, which is a very simple XML document. It just says that there's going to be an output root element of being, and we're going to use three data elements on it. They're going to be pulled out of this registry running on my local machine, and these are the UUIDs, or the unique identifiers of each one of these. We're going to feed in also the context of use as an argument, and if you look at the batch file that's going to run this utility. You see I've got the unique identifier of the context here. There's the assembly guide represented as the first parameter we're going to feed the assembly utility, and the last thing we're going to do is feed it an output name. So I'm going to feed it a name of December 1, 2004. This context key ends with 23F, and if we look in our registry, we'll see that 23F is the English language context key. I'm going to put the registry window up so you can see this running. And just so you see this is real, when I hit DIR, you don't see any file here listed as December 1st, 2004.xsd. So I'm going to run this. You'll see the top window move by as it makes calls to the registry. We now have a file in here. Oops, I forgot to save it after the November 8th. Apologies here. Now I have the December 1st, 2001-1 file, which we're going to open and look at. You know I've done this a few times when I've got a folder that says things that went wrong. So here is our schema. The schema contains simply three data elements, and there to mark up a being. The first one is the first name, and there's a different type. The second is a gender identifier, and there's 10 different values for that. You all thought there was only two or three this morning. And the third is the being type identifier, which has four values ranging from humanoid down to known spammer. I'm now going to run this again, but before I run it, what I'm going to do is go back to the registry and imagine at this point that I've built this transaction and I've said, okay, we're going to assemble it for the context of deployment to English-speaking Canada. I've kept my same high-level model of my business process and my transaction, and I've just contextually specialized for that. I now go back and take the one context key back out of the registry for the French-speaking language, and I cut and paste that into this batch file to run this thing, and I run it again. I think I saved it. Well, no, in a second. When I hit reload, this should all be now in French language. And as you can see, it is. At this point, we take this thing into the Adobe Forms Designer, which accepts any XML schema in and can design a PDF in a couple of minutes. And any instance would actually be compliant with the schema that the form and then bind that back into a SOAP endpoint or anywhere else you want to put that good stuff. Now jumping back to the demonstration, or to the PowerPoint, rather. The benefits of this are immense. I was asked to do this by somebody who was on EBX and the core component or drinking in Brussels. He said, I don't think any of this stuff is implementable. Dwayne, you implement it, so I was there a fan. So he antagonized me enough where I got my hands dirty and did some stuff. The reuse of data elements is a huge benefit. That's some of the problems John highlighted that UBL was looking at. Imagine if we did nothing with all of this, but just kept people from making more XML languages going forward or inventing more data elements. That would be a huge benefit if we could stop that today and just use what's already done. Or have at least a mechanism where people could find the elements through a registry repository and they're semantically discoverable in a way that's meaningful to those people. Preserving the mask. One of the nice things about what I just showed you is that once I have all the background work of the core component libraries and the actual BIEs built in here, for people to develop new transactions, they don't have to know the system it's going to integrate with or any of the technical stuff about that. By doing this, they actually save themselves or their organization an entire integration problem later on because all all that information about the data formats that need to be set specifically back to that application are all contained and encapsulated. That's a really important thing to know. This could actually destroy a large part of the middleware market. The semantics have to be and are referenceable in context, and the bilingual display and semantic support is absolutely imperative, and I've got bilingual here. It should really read multilingual display. This was cut and pasted from a presentation I did in Canada. The unified view of data for applications is important. Centralized maintenance of the data elements and the flexibility is supported for custom transactions, and this is a huge thing. This is another mistake that a lot of standard bodies have made when they've made languages. They've been a little bit naive and a little bit arrogant that a group of people like us here could sit in a room and define once and for all what is needed for this language, when the real users are and their requirements evolve over time. When the requirements evolve, they have to have changes to the language to reflect that. This mechanism with core components, the context methodology, isn't that. And of course, the integration to existing systems is supported. And the rapid development and design is also very important. So that's all I had to present. And we're going to hold all the questions for later. And there's a few references there. And I'll somebody reminds me during the Q&A, I'll actually cough up the URL for the registry at the Canadian government with all the data elements in it. Thank you very much.
Okay, that is terrific. We should be, it's 3:14, so if there is actually anything out there to drink, we ought to be able still to get it. If there's not, I suggest a trip downstairs to get something. Let's take exactly a 15-minute break so we can keep in sync with folks on the phone. So, folks on the phone, it is now 3:15 in Menlo Park, and we will resume at 3:30, which should be 15 minutes from now. I will leave the bridge up because it's a lot easier than dialing back in. But if you want to dial back in, that should work too. And I will open the phone up to you being able to speak to us when we do the interactive panel part of this.
We're back here in 15.
I hope they didn't kill somebody.
Well,
here to
Okay, let's try and get restarted here. Our next speakers are going to be Adam Pease and Peter Yim, talking about explicit semantics for business ontology from the Ontolog Forum. And I've reminded them to stand here and scream at the phone. That's right. So we try not to drop out for you folks on the phone. I understand that that's frustrating.
All yours.
Okay.
Thank you, John. And I promised Adam, who is the real ontologist, that I would be quick and let him sort of have as much time to explain our position as we can. This is what we're going to talk about. I'll make a sort of brief introduction of the Ontolog Forum, and Adam would come in, tell people, what ontologies are, if you don't already know. The suggested upper merged ontology, which is a project that he has been working on most of his professional life, and it's the core piece that we are basing our methodology on. Adam would also describe a core component type representation effort that has been one of the key projects that the Ontolog Forum folks have been engaging in. So, Ontolog, a little bit of history. We actually started out sometime in April 2004 with Leo Oberst, who I believe is on the phone, myself, and Jack Park, giving a talk to the UBL people on semantics, ontology, and UBL. Of course, that raised some interest, but not enough to generate a subcommittee or enough interest to work. And after that, we also decided that because of different timelines, it would be best, and actually that was suggested by Kurt, that we run a community that sort of works in parallel, and hence around September 2002, the Ontolog Forum reconstituted as an open international forum to discuss practical issues and strategies associated with the development of both formal, of course, and also informal ontologies used in business. So we are essentially about the business domain ontologies, and of course, on the side, identify ontological engineering approaches that might be applied to the UBL effort. Of course, that went into our mission statement at that time. Since then, we're trying to address those issues on the broader domain of e-business standards efforts. And by now, after 2.5 years or so, we've got about 100 members from 12 or 13 different countries, involving like industry, government, academia, and they're fairly geographically distributed, as you can see from the countries they represent. Among our activities, which included like specific projects as well as like weekly phone calls, monthly invited speakers, we have one project a few projects that are collaborations in business ontologies. And these, for example, are the ones that Adam would talk about, and specifically the CCT ontology. I'm not going to read out the names, but I mean, just to make this, what we talk about today, happen, we've got contributions from this whole list of people. The names are probably some familiar names that you know, and of course, among them you see people from various organizations, as well as familiar names that, I mean, that of people that wear different hats. I mean, you might see their name as son, but at the same time, they may be a person who's also on several OASIS process, technical committees, or UNCZ working groups, and so on. And the CCT representation project that Adam is going to talk about has a goal to influence the adoption of ontology in e-business standards, and that's why we're speaking here. The mission, of course, was to ontologize the EBXML core component types. John talked about it a little earlier, Ron did, Dwayne, of course, whole talk was on CCTs, and in particular on the CCTs, which are the core component types. We wanted to produce a reference CCT ontology and to report on the findings and recommendations. Today's report is sort of an interim report. We are not totally done, but we've gathered enough insights that we should deliver something that's interesting. So our delivery today includes the presentation as well as a paper that Kurt and Bo Newman and Bob Smith, who are also Ontolog members, have put together, and the paper is at that corner of the table, which you can pick up. For the remote participants, there's a wiki page on the Ontolog site and both the presentation and the paper is downloadable from there. So I'll give the podium to Adam, who will describe what the rest of the agenda is.
Great, thanks, Peter. Okay, so just a slide from one of our contributors from government. So this is a way of sort of expressing where do we fall in the space of different kinds of standards. So it might be said that older style standards, and here Steve Ray's reference ISO 14258, essentially a dated dictionary or a lexicon with an English term and an English definition that one can read to understand what this term actually means. More modern standards, might be characterized as data model standards, actually have at least a semi-formal or structural language that describes these terms and puts them in relation to one another. And the assertion that we're making is that the more modern standards, real cutting-edge standards, such as my own work on suggested upper-merged ontology, or several others, including the PSL project at NIST, are relying on full formal logic.
Friends, if this is...
Okay.
They can see it.
So let me relate to the tag x83. What does that mean? Well, you can say x83 goes into the data dictionary and has the following definition. Computer goes in there and it sees more English. It doesn't read English. It doesn't understand English. It sees more meaningless characters. It doesn't know what x83 or job or name actually mean. Well, we say, wait, now there's taxonomies. And the Department of Defense now has a standard DOD taxonomy group that they're very excited about. So maybe taxonomies are going to solve this. So let's say we've got Joe Smith, and he's an instance of person, and people are mammals. Well, again, the computer sees this. It sees, you know, I-3729. So I'm moving rapidly here. Apologies to the folks on the phone. I'm now on slide 13. So we say, well, wait, maybe semantics is the answer. Of course, what does semantics mean? Well, we'll get into that. So now we've got some semantic relations, some relations that actually are imbued with some standard meaning, instance and subclass. And so Joe Smith is an instance of a person, the subclass of mammal. And because we've got some formal semantics, some formal meaning, that tells us that instance is transitive through subclass, and therefore we can logically conclude that Joe Smith is also an instance of mammal as well as an instance of person. What does the computer see? Well, you guessed it from the previous slide. It sees this collection of meaningless symbols, but it's a little bit better because now R53 and R22 have some formal semantics in them. The machine at least can do this parallel conclusion to the bottom right-hand picture. And
what semantics are giving us, they're not giving us full understanding. You know, there still are a meaningless collection of symbols, but we're giving at least the illusion or the utility of something that looks like understanding if we don't dig too deep. Because if we have enough of these formal semantic relations, then the machine is going to be doing the same conclusions that you and I are able to do and giving us information that's consistent with our knowledge of the world. So the more semantics you have, the closer we get to something that at least appears like it's doing something smart and useful. And now on slide 15, let's not get into the actual debate, although I'd be maybe happy to do that offline because it's a lot of fun. Definition, slide 16. So ontology, so those of you that like myself, who were excited about object-oriented technology, went through the period of hype with object-oriented technology where object-oriented then became a synonym for good, and so there was object-oriented COBOL, and everybody wanted to be object-oriented because it gave you an extra $10,000 on your salary. Ontology is going through the same unfortunate thing, so I'm going to try to ground the definition a little bit with my view of the world. So the broader definition, ontology is a shared conceptualization of a domain. Second bullet is really what I look to. An ontology is a set of definitions in a formal language for terms describing the world. And the clause formal language is really important because without a formal language, you have essentially a thesaurus or a dictionary or something a human being has to interpret. If you have a formal language with some formal logical semantics, the machine can actually do some inference. It can draw some new conclusions. It can appear in tiny ways like it's doing something smart. So let's put all this on a spectrum. Now, there are lots of people have a slide that's similar to this. I'm going to give one here thanks to Leo Oberst from MITRE.
And I'm here.
And you're there. Thank you. expressiveness on the vertical and formality on the horizontal. So let's look first. You know, human language is extremely expressive. It, by definition, it's evolved to say whatever we want it to say, but it's not very formal. It's ambiguous. We have, you know, ambiguity in our word senses, we have ambiguity in interpretation, we have ambiguity in anaphoric reference, the pronominal reference, lots of problems that make human language just unsuitable as a language for machine understanding. We don't have machines that can actually read English or any other human natural language. So we've invented this whole spectrum of other languages that are trying to get us to this magical far upper right where we have something that's totally formal that a machine can understand and yet totally expressive, so we can say whatever we want to say and not to have something outside the language like an English definition that then means the human being has to resort to reading that to understand what that term or that element or that class actually means. So in the bottom right we have what I would characterize as standards for syntax. And syntax standardization is absolutely necessary. You can't get away without that, but it's not sufficient. You've got to have meaning. You've got to have something beyond that. So for the semantic web, we're here somewhere in the middle right now with logics that have a little bit of semantics, a little bit of semantic interoperability. You can say that one thing is a subclass of another. But what I think we really want to do is get farther to the upper right, where there's a whole host of different things. We can state rules. We can state formal axioms about what things actually mean. Another issue now on slide 18 that's really been ignored, unfortunately, in the ontology research community, or not so much in the business community, because you guys, you know, speaking broadly, you folks that actually are doing something useful in the business community, you're concerned about content. You want to know what those tags actually mean so you can exchange some data. And a sad fact about the research community in ontology, other than content, you want to have magic time. Already, I think, centrally been concerned about the meanings of tags and creating enough tags that allow you to say things in a way that everybody has agreed on. So looking at it very broadly and sketchily at the world, so we have large taxonomies that are relatively informal, like Yahoo. You know, one web page is more specific maybe than another web page, not really saying much. There are lexicons that are somewhat more formal. They may have a broader space of semantic relation. And then what I would call the formal ontology of the world, and I'm really only aware of three, although it's arguable there are a couple others that could be included in there. There's Zeit, there's my own project, the Suggested Upper Merged Ontology, and then there's a European effort called Dolcic. And so I'll get hopefully into a little more detail, or maybe we can even talk offline since time is short,
about what actually characterizes those things specifically in that far right of the state. So just a brief slide on implementation. I won't have much of a chance to get into this. There's lots of different ways to do implementation, as you all know, and so we're creating standards that are highly expressive, but the actual implementation of that standard may well be in a relational database and not using some fancy first-order logic theorem prover and a logic engine and the logical language. So I'll just allude to that and maybe offline individually and come back to that. So there's lots of efforts now to employ the suggested upper merged ontology as well as some of the domain ontology stuff that we're working on. So Peter Denno at NIST, in fact, has a whole implementation, a whole tool for doing some data cataloging that I'm just going to show to you very briefly here. We're also, again, expressing things in many different languages. There's a whole effort that Pat Cassidy now at MITRE is doing to try to express all of the upper ontology in a more taxonomically oriented language called Protégé that's very popular in the ontology community. Okay, now let me shift gears a little bit to upper ontology. Why do we need an upper ontology? What is an upper ontology? It's an attempt to capture the most general and reusable terms that go across domains. Now, people say, why do you need this totally high-level abstract stuff? Why don't I need the practical stuff that actually makes a difference in my domain? Well, the fact is that very high-level things do have a very practical impact. So several years ago, I and a large number of other people did a formal study on a problem for the government in reasoning about international crisis situations. We had hundreds of different test questions that we had a machine answering formally against a very, very large body of knowledge, millions of facts. And we did an assessment of how many of those facts came from different parts of our ontology to determine, does the upper ontology really have an impact? And we found that in the answers, in the explanations for the answers, fully one-third of the terms that were used in either stating the answer or explaining the answer came directly from the upper ontology. It was statements like, this event happened before some other event. There are relations like this that are just ubiquitous in any practical problem. And so it's not enough, I would say, to focus just on the domain level, because that ignores the reuse that's possible across domains at the upper level. And those are absolutely practical definitions that can be reused again and again on practical problems. I'm now on slide 23. I'm going to pre-respond to questions that I often get in talks like this. So there's often a question I get, well, how can we have just one upper ontology? Don't people have different views about the world? Aren't there different cultural issues? Well, my take on this is, yes, there are, but those fundamentally are not issues of ontology. They're either issues of language or knowledge. And so I try to divide out the space in this way, that there are ontologies which are expandable. They're language independent. They're machine understandable. And then there are language or lexicons, which are things that are understood by humans and ambiguous. And so one of the things we did very early on in the SUMO project was to separate ontology and language and say, all the terms that we create, we're going to happen to write them in English, but they're actually formal terms. That the English is just a comment, it's a label that we can put on things. Now, I haven't had time a little later to go into detail on how we've translated SUMO to a wide variety of foreign non-English languages, I should say, just to show that there is no deep language dependence on this ontology. It's a language-independent construct. And so we've related it separately to various human natural languages. So each term, each formal term in the logical theory has a corresponding word or sense in English in a large lexicon. But they're not the same. They're different. And so when people use an informal human natural language to talk about things, they're putting labels on concepts. Those labels may be ambiguous. There may be multiple labels for the same thing. But those concepts, if they're high-level concepts, are fundamentally going to be shared by everybody. They're part of common sense reality. The notion that something happens before, some event happens before another event, is a universal concept. And it's only the name for beforeness that's going to change between different languages and sometimes between different technical communities. So we keep those things separate. Another thing that we separate out is the notion of knowledge. People have different opinions. They have different facts about the world. But that doesn't mean that the terms, the concepts in the world that they have are necessarily different. It simply means they either say these things are true or false, or maybe they refer to them by a different name. So by separating these three things out, we gain a lot of traction, a lot of clarity in helping us understand what things are universal, what things actually belong in ontology, and what things don't. So now let me talk briefly about SUMO itself. So SUMO is a project that's been going on for about 3 years. The upper ontology, just arbitrarily, we set a limit. We said 1,000 terms is big enough, and any new term would add to that, we're going to put that in the domain ontology, just to keep the upper level sort of clean and minimal. So it has 1,000 terms, 4,000 axioms, 750 of those axioms or formal statements are if-then sorts of rules, the same thing you'd find in an expert system, which comes in the 1980s. As I mentioned, we mapped everything to a lexicon, so some of you may be familiar with the WordNet Natural Language Lexicon from Princeton. We mapped to version 1.6 and ported to the most recent 2.0. We're operating within an IEEE standards group that's also working on several other different ontologies, but I won't mention them in this talk. And as I did mention, that we have a lot of domain ontologies, so some 20,000 terms and 60,000 axioms. So the work that we're doing in UBL, and specifically the core component types, is essentially work on a domain ontology that extends our upper level. And all of this stuff is free, so hopefully some of you will find this interesting and you'll look on your own. It's all downloadable for free on my website. It's formally defined. It's not dependent on a particular implementation. We use a standard first-order logic, a particular syntax, but it's nothing that's really new from a representational standpoint in the past 100 years. You know, Frege came up with first-order logic around the turn of the century, and that's what we're doing. There's an open-source toolkit that you can download. And there are lots of different people around the world, most gratifyingly people that send me messages periodically to find out they're from, you know, different corners of the world. They haven't talked to me. They just said, oh, we've done this nifty project with your stuff because we downloaded it, and now we have some questions. That's really one of the most gratifying things that I find. In fact, there's a group in Taiwan that's just doing outstanding work on linguistic analogy based on SUMO. WordNet, I mentioned, large free lexicon produced at Princeton, the standard in the linguistics world. It gives a relation between a formal ontology now and WordNet as sort of a massive lexicon. So it essentially relates SUMO to a massive vocabulary, and it's been really useful for me for some natural language research I've done. SUMO is a modular ontology. It has 11 separable modules with the following dependency structure, very relatively general set and class theory, units of measure, ontology of processes, qualities, and myriad topology, just in case you're wondering, means parts and places. So such as, you know, something is below or above something else is one of the things in the myriad topology direction. Again, lots of domain ontologies, primarily in government and military areas, since that's been my principal funding, but a lot of it is quite general and reusable, even for the business domain we're finding. So actually, the CCT ontology that we've come up with actually uses bits and pieces of a lot of these very specific ontologies, and it's quite a large system altogether. Okay, so now let me talk about CCT. So it looks like I actually had a schedule, amazingly enough. okay, so we tried to start out looking at all of UBL, and then realized, gosh, this is way too big. We've got to focus down and do something a little bit more near-term, or something we can accomplish more in the near-term. So then we had guidance to look at our component types in particular. And so we found, I hope these statistics are right, there are 10 core components, and then there are 43 different supplemental components. We mapped all of these to suggested upper merged ontology, and we found that with SUMO plus its domain ontologies, there were only actually 7 concepts that we didn't have already. And so we had to create those 7 concepts. And the 7 concepts are not deep concepts. There's like the notion of, you know, MIME type, or I think was one of them, and maybe file name. Okay. So all the fundamental stuff we have, and all of this mapping is online for us, for everyone to see. So here's one of the usual slides that's unreadable from the back of the room. But just to show you that this stuff really exists, we have a big spreadsheet showing the mappings, and then specific, this is the CCT rep file in logic that is the stuff that's necessary, these 7 concepts or so that are necessary to extend the upper ontology. Here, for example, is the definition that we already had in a distributed computing ontology for the notion of a uniform resource identifier. And here, just begin to distinguish the notion of a formal ontology from taxonomies or data models. We have not only, you know, a term and a dictionary definition sort of thing, but, and not only do we have the notion of a class-subclass relation, as you'd find in any sort of taxonomy, that a uniform resource identifier is a subtype of this generic notion of a content-bearing object. But we also have formal logical axioms in first-order logic with your usual existential and universal quantifications that you may remember from your logic course in college. If any of you had such a course, I'm sure many of you did. But it's probably lost in the midst of time unless you've stayed active with this sort of stuff. So the notion, the meaning that is inherent in uniform resource identifier is not the meaning that's brought to it merely by its class membership or merely by its English definition, but by its formal logical axioms that will enable a machine, by following the standard principles of first-order logic, to deduce new information on the basis of the facts that it has. So it actually has some element of understanding as opposed to just labeling and composition relationships. And this is just the online mapping. So you can actually go to any core component type or supplemental type. You can go to the sumo mapping and hyperclick on the term. And you can go in and see the full formal logical definitions for those terms. So a couple of issues, still pretty early in this process. I don't feel like we have closure on these issues where we've been able to help. But I think we've been able to identify that there is at least some problem or confusion or ambiguity possibly, at least amongst some of the people participating in this effort and how they determine, how they interpret each of these notions. The notion of code versus identifier, I'd offer maybe it's an issue of purpose and not of content, that they're actually the same. And it's really just the context of use of these items rather than any inherent difference between them. I would certainly welcome your feedback offline to help me get a handle on what the intent was on these two items. And we just assert that, you know, even if it's just an issue of process, just of holding this discussion, of just doing this analysis with respect to a formal upper ontology, I think we're going to be able to help people get a greater degree of clarity in either what was intended in the term or, in fact, in helping the expression or the communication of the intent of the meaning for each of these terms. So the ontology is helping both as, I think, an end result and as a systems analysis or information analysis tool in the design process of terminological standards. So the business case. So kind of summing up, why do you want to do this thing? Because we're essentially here making a recommendation. We think this is a good idea, and we'd like to have everybody that's doing data model standards, taxonomy standards, terminological standards, to look seriously at formal upper ontology and see how it can help, because I believe personally that there is probably not a terminological standard in process today that could not be helped or improved somewhat by taking elements of the formal ontologically based definition process. So standards development is hard work. It's incredibly hard work. It's painful. It's long-term, and we assert that most standards bodies work a lot harder than they have to. Why do they work harder than they have to, and what can we do to help? So standard-setting bodies, we believe, and I think this hopefully will not be a controversial statement, are susceptible to ontological gaps. They're susceptible to having things that are implicit in their terms and definitions and relationships, that it takes a lot of hard, painful, long-term work to express and make explicit. Okay? People make a lot of assumptions, and part of the reason they make assumptions and part of the reason they have knowledge that's implicit is because of the tools that the industry has had available for expressing knowledge. If your tools for expressing your knowledge are taxonomic relations or English definitions, there is ambiguity that is inherent in that. And so there's a benefit from taking that ambiguity, from taking that implicit knowledge that's built into English definitions or definitions in some other human language and making them formal and explicit. It can
can be a little painful, but it's going to get those gaps taken care of up front at design time rather than later on in the process when somebody realizes, well, what do we actually mean with code versus identifier? You know, even if somebody on the team can't express conclusively what one means versus the other, that's a sign that, you know, there was something implicit that was left in the expression of the definition of these terms. And ontology, formal ontology with an upper ontology, essentially doesn't let you get away with that. It forces you to make these things explicit. It forces you to make concrete choices for where you're going to put your new term as extensions to the existing large formal hierarchy that's already said, here's the whole matrix of decisions we need to make about what we call things in our world, at least at a very high level. You've got to make a choice. Do I put it here or do I put it there? And each of those choices has significant implications for your definition. So you don't have to create that definition, that complete semantic definition from scratch. It's going to be done for you by virtue of where you choose to position things in this hierarchy, at least a healthy start at that. Very valuable stuff. We'd also assert that ontologically formalized standards should be easier to adopt because there are lots of different paths for migration, interoperability, and integration. I didn't have a chance to talk about a lot of those. I only flashed up briefly that slide for four different generic types of implementation, but I'd love to talk with you about that offline. We assert that there are some essential components. Now, there's certainly difference of opinion in the research community, but this is what I've found, and I think this is what the ontolog community, at least a significant portion of it, is finding, that this approach yields the greatest benefits when you do formal ontological engineering and also the choices that are inherent in using a standardized upper ontology. We believe the ontological engineering approach will identify knowledge gaps, will identify things that are implicit and need to be addressed and made explicit. And as a result, and this is one thing I think that's particularly powerful, is by virtue of having to make these formal explicit choices up front, early in the process, by not being able to defer ambiguity that is built into informal human language, that the resulting standards will simply be more stable. They'll be better standards. There'll be less problems later on because simply there's less space for disagreement, confusion, and ambiguity early on. And ultimately, that will provide a more rapid return on investment for the standards work that so much money is going into. And that's it. Thanks very much.
Okay, what we want to do now is form you guys into a panel. And folks on the phone, please bear with us for a couple minutes. We're going to rearrange some things here. I'm going to turn the projector off.
What kind of ontology will you use for that?
Hang on, that's a question. Hang on. There we go. And I'm going to, while I'm doing this, I want the panelists to grab a chair and gather around to the center of the table, which is where we're placed this Polycom. People on the phone, watch out. I'm going to move the equipment. It's going to make a lot of noise. CCTS earlier, and Ron Schulte, who talked about UDEF earlier, and I'm going to hit that, which should unmute the people we have on the phone. So folks on the phone, you should be able to ask questions now. Those of us who are spread around the room, if you have a question, you are
probably going to have to shout it for the people on the phone to even have the remotest possibility of hearing it. So it might be a good idea for people responding to somehow cue in what the question was as you do that. Okay? So we're now open, and you can certainly feel free to ask questions of each other. Folks, you've been sitting on questions all this time.
I have a question here. I'm maybe confused about what you said. You have to, accommodate CCT by adding this concept of file name to your ontological system. You know, to me, isn't that file name a two different concepts? I mean, there's a file, there's a name, and should be in a different position in your ontological tree. Well, you know, I don't understand what do you mean by you have to add.
Okay, so that's a good question. It actually brings out the issue of relations versus classes. So you're actually talking, I think, about two things. A file, an object, an instance, a particular instance, has a relationship, file name, to a string of characters, which is the file name. Okay, so there are, well, I guess, really three things here. There's two objects and a relation. Okay, and so we already had the notion of in Sumo's symbolic string to handle the file name. We already had the notion of computer file, and we had the notion names, a very generic relationship between a thing and the name it carries. So, you know, we have names, the object, Adam, and the string, ADAM. But we didn't have specifically file name, so the notion that this is a name that is specifically held or kept in file system about relating a file to its string of characters that is the identifier for that file. That was what we had to add.
I would assert that it's deeper than that, too, because the file name also has a relationship to the person using it. If it's the computer using it, it's a machine bytecode representation of that name. It's different than the name you might present to somebody in a localized language.
Well, that at least in our domain here, is a difference, I guess, in terminology, okay? So
yeah.
The computer has, you know, what it would call a file name, and the person has, as a separate agent, has what it would call a file name. But in fact, the concept of the relationship between a file and its string of human-supplied characters, that is what the file name is. And we may well create a different relation that may have a different English label on it, which is really coincidental. It carries no real information. It's just a convenient identifier for human understanding. And we may call that, you know, computer name. But those two concepts exist, and you're right that they are distinct.
Respond to that.
Could you restate that, please?
Yeah,
I couldn't hear it.
About to. Yeah, the question was, okay, what's the big picture here? For example, how might this relate to something like UBL? I'm going to take UBL in this case as an example of many similar projects, okay? The basic problem to be solved is here I have one syntax, and here I have a different syntax. Are they saying the same thing? Okay, that's really what it boils down to. So, for example, our XREF project here in EIDX is about forming a matrix and trying to slog through the question of, you know, here is an X12 version of a set of elements in a purchase order. Here is a RosettaNet. Here is a CBL. Here are what we think are the equivalents. Okay, so in an 850, you've got this term, in CBL you've got this term, in RosettaNet you've got this term, and it's our finding as business experts that these in fact express the same concept, right? But there are some complications. One of the complications, which actually I'll probably rephrase as a question when I get to it, is what do we do about things where they almost match but not quite? Like they don't, they're saying pretty much the same thing but not exactly. That's a big problem. And another is simply where's the grounding here? And there are various we've been presented implicitly in these presentations with various ways to ground things. So I'm kind of a simpleton about all this. I'm kind of where you are with this. I'm listening to these things. I'm going, okay, I sort of understand what's going on here. I'm still stuck back at the level where here I have a term, here I have an English definition. Here I have another term, does it mean the same thing? Well, I'm going to find out by seeing if I can find its definition and then comparing the definition. All right? Another way is to say, well, these live-in taxonomies of meaning, can I compare at that level? Can I say they live in the same place in some taxonomy, therefore they must mean the same thing? Or I might find out if I'm looking at it taxonomically, oh, this is pretty much in the same neighborhood, but it's a subclass of this other thing. It's not identical to it. It's a special instance of it. Okay. And then we have, with ontologies, we're getting to the point where we can actually have rules associated with these things. But to me, I'm just starting to try and figure this out myself. So I'm the wrong person to ask about that. But the basic problem is trying to establish whether something expressed in one set of in one syntax is equivalent to the other thing. That's the most basic problem, because people are trying to implement things like adapters and translators. Okay, and the biggest problem is how do we get that equivalence? But other, please, the panelists.
Yeah. Yeah. So when it would, to answer your question, I would phrase the relationship as, you know, the question that John and others have posed is the seemingly simple one at first. It's analyzing something and figuring out the meaning of it. And the presentations you've heard from us are kind of a byproduct of a realization when we looked at that question. We realized that the underlying mechanisms that determine that aren't as obvious or as simple as they first appear. There's actually a very large degree of complexity surrounding it. Any one thing and try to get general consensus on it and everyone sees it the same way, there's always going to be some ambiguity. Even within using the same word in the English language, let's go buy some stock and we're on Wall Street in New York, we're going to do one thing. If we're at a cattle ranch in Missouri, we're going to do something else. So it's a very complex problem, and these are kind of, I think there's a lot of really good research that was presented by these guys, and it's all going to somehow fit in as part of the solution. None of us are probably sure or would be arrogant if we assumed we knew what the total answer was for the holy grail of solving this.
This is Leo Obers. Could I comment on that?
Please.
Yeah. One of the issues is that you can't relate different syntaxes according to their meaning unless you specify the meaning. So now, currently, you're using basically data dictionaries. Two human strings, right? Two human definitions to define your constructs. And then you try to correlate those two definitions basically with a human in the loop, right? Saying, oh, these are the same definitions. Well, what ontologies are trying to provide is a logical representation of the meaning of both of those sides, right? So that a machine could, in fact, correlate those kind of in at least a semi-automated fashion. So the issue is you can't provide the meaning, you can't provide mappings between syntaxes unless you know the mappings between the semantics of those syntaxes.
And even that is just the beginning of it, because you cannot define the semantics of one single thing, because when that thing gets used in a different set of circumstances, it actually changes the semantics of it. And I think that's all part of that framework.
Yes, right. No, I agree. And that's typically called pragmatics on the semantic pragmatics spectrum. And what that means is that you have to define the semantics within context based upon the use and intent of that semantics. So it changes from one context to another, but that's part of really the extended semantics of that.
Mm-hmm. At least we agreed on what to call it. Right. The problem.
I'd like to take another pass at that, and hopefully it's consistent with everything everyone said. Am I loud enough on the phone?
Just about. Yeah.
Yeah, it's even louder. Things coming to me, and I'll hold it still.
take it out of kind of the mechanics of what's going on, I think the big picture issue to a large degree has to do with how do we judge the quality of a data standard? Ideally, how do we find quality standards for data standards? And what committees tend to do is, by their nature, take the approach of consensus. If we reach consensus, that is in and of itself a measure of quality.
Right.
But that still leaves open the question of, is it correct from an objective standpoint? And how are we going to define correctness in a more objective fashion than just consensus? And that's where you get in the idea of semantic modeling and conceptual modeling, almost as a grounding of correctness that can be used then to judge whether or not these data models are likely to have stability long term.
Yeah, so one of the other things that I think we maybe should address then is, you know, we're talking about starting with some informal or semi-formal source documents. And so, you know, yes, there's going to be this problem of different words being used to mean different things. And linguistically, some of that is disambiguated as a result of context. But I think what, at least my work, I'm trying to get away from, in a way, is language and the problem of context. By not having the terms be dependent on the context, but rather defining terms independent of context that then maybe can be linked to an independent and or a contextually dependent word.
Yes.
And if I can amplify on what you just said, that's where I would also make the argument that those objects, those fundamental objects in UDEF and those fundamental properties of UDEF are contextually independent, because an enterprise and a product and a person, you know, those are fundamental objects that I hope nearly everybody on the planet has in their mind in general, but those basic objects are. Your example of code and identifier, offline I can explain how I teach that, but in a nutshell, an identifier is something that you cannot possibly have the complete list because it is continually growing. Like a Social Security number is an identifier for a person, and there's no way in the world that you could have a list of all valid values unless you were the Social Security Administration. And even then, you may not ever have a completely up-to-date list. So an identifier is a continuous, in other words, there's a time dimension that separates identifier from code. A code is something that, it's like a lookup table where you have all possible values, all valid values. And that would be a code.
So that sounds good. So that sounds like something I could actually code up in Axiom. So one of the, I think then the advantage of the ontology approach is that then we're not dependent upon an English speaker may find that unambiguous, but rather that we've created a formal term which then can be in turn translated to other non-English languages. So for example, for Sumo, we have translations that are available in Czech, Italian, German, Hindi, Chinese, and Tagalog. And these translations are generated now automatically from the axioms. So somebody who is a native Chinese speaker who doesn't speak English can still use Sumo because the terms in Sumo are not in any way dependent upon an understanding of English syntax or grammar or vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
It's strictly dependent upon one's understanding of, you know, these Chinese labels then on terms which are really defined in first-order logic.
This is Steve Ray. Could I make a comment real quick? I was hearing, I presume that was Ron, talking about the UDEF in terms like enterprise and person, right?
Yes.
I was just wondering the sort of the intersection between the UDEF work and the Sumo work, is I was presuming that how those could blend would be where you would, in fact, axiomatize some of those terms like enterprise and person, because I guess I don't really see those as atomic-based things. Those themselves, I think, are subject to a certain amount of interpretation. Is that how you both, maybe, I don't know, Adam and Ron see it, or?
I believe that the concept of an enterprise, when you look at the definition of enterprise versus person,
uh-huh.
Granted, you can have
you know, it's a legal entity of some nature. In other words, it's got one or more persons in it, but it's something that's a legal entity.
But when you say, when you look at the definition of enterprise, are you talking about an English text definition?
No, I'm talking about the way it's defined according to UDEF.
And how is that expressed?
The only definitions that are in UDEF are for those basic 16 objects as well as the 18 properties.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything else underneath the UDEF, which is its taxonomy, is based on what I'd call the experts in that field. For instance, much of UDEF was built on the configuration management experts, you know, in the U.S. being involved in basically helping build that portion of the UDEF taxonomy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the, you know, the best practice, the best terminology, if you will, but then following the rules for UDEF. So it's, you know, and then as it then was used to analyze and map things in the procurement world, so purchase orders and invoices and such, those terms, you know, it was an analysis of what did X12 call it, what did XCBL call it, what did OAGIS call it,
mm-hmm.
and then what kind of common terminology, you know, could accurately, completely describe that concept. So it's taking the experts in the field and using the terminology that's used most commonly, and then applying it with the rules of UDEF to come up with that, you know, if you will, taxonomy.
But Steve, I mean, I think fundamentally, though you're right. I mean, I think you're both right here. I think, Steve, what you're recommending is that taking that best terminology that's been defined in all these different communities and has already been related, that to now take the definition of the concept that lies behind that terminology and express it formally in logical axioms, hopefully with respect to SUMO.
Yeah.
That would be a positive thing.
Like, I think so, too.
Right.
Yeah, the issue is, you know, that typically these taxonomies are built with in terms of terminology as opposed to concepts, right? So there has to be a translation that has to be undergone then. Because the terminologies are what the experts actually use in the field, but the model, the semantics that's behind that is probably not the same thing as that taxonomic tree.
Well, it's carried around in the heads of those experts, and that's, I think, the challenge that we're facing is trying to make as much of that explicit as possible.
Which is what the UDEF tries to do.
Is the UDEF...
Sorry, Leo, we have a question from the back. So.
Sure.
Distribute the microphones. Right, it won't. Why don't we leave them on the microphone? Pause while our speaker comes forward.
Oh, okay. Separate from there. Okay. So my question comes as total ignorance. I am sitting in on here because I am interested in the philosophy and where the direction is coming from. I have within my company a proposal that in order to resolve some of the issues of trying to deal with the fact that we support multiple industry formats, and have, unfortunately, many SAP instances plus other backends in the company that are using their own versions of everything as well, that we have not just a many-to-one, we have a many-to-many kind of situations of translation. And the proposal is that we come up with some kind of canonical model to try and separate ourselves from the backend issues of doing their own thing. So I'm listening to your discussions and thinking, would this help me to achieve my canonical model? And what I'm hearing sounds like a lot of nouns and adjectives with classes with their adjectives as qualifiers, and the properties are another lot of nouns and adjectives, and I'm saying, okay, so where are the verbs? And I'm also saying, I know I have a lot of conditions. I think Sumo might be getting towards verbs. What about the conditions? And I'm going to give you a precise real life example, because we need to get back from the theory down to real life. How do we use this? I, in my company, have distanced ourselves from these different industry formats. If I am trying to get back to the subject here of standards, by saying that we've developed a business content for messaging for our particular company use, and that we will then map that to every one of the industry formats that we support. So beginning conceptually to this idea of a canonical format, but obviously it doesn't have a real-life thing that I can put it in as in the computer to use. Okay, I have a specific instance in a shipment notification, okay, back down to real life here. We all know that shipment notification is a very common used message through all of the businesses in many different contexts. And we know that a lot of the time, one shipment equals one order. But we also know we have several instances where we have one shipment equals multiple orders. We're well in the XML format that we have a lot of people complaining they don't want to use XML because they have to carry the overhead of all the extra tags. So, in the instance if we have one shipment and one order, or at least all going to the same particular business party, that we would like to put that up at the header once and once only. But we want to accommodate those issues where if we have multiple orders or where they are going to multiple sold to parties, maybe obviously single ship to, but multiple sold to parties, that we could have an override at our detail level to be able to accommodate those in that instance. And to even go to the issue of saying most of them are going to the same place, so we will put it in the header and only override it at the detail. Now this is what I call conditional, and it's very specific, and I'm saying how would an ontology be able to resolve it if I'm going after a canonical model?
So, all three of us
okay.
are
going to respond here. May I respond, especially the last one, because I mean,
I'll take you one about process.
Yeah, I mean, so I mean, sumo has nouns, verbs, or the things that linguistically would correspond to nouns, verbs, adjectives, properties, modals, you know, conditionals, all the things that you're looking for are in there. In sumo alone, there's an ontology of 175 different process types. The domain ontologies extend that considerably. Process types can have various properties attached to them that talk about manner. And the first order logical rules are the things that you're looking for in the conditionals. So we can say, if the following things are true, then these other things follow. And that's a fundamental aspect of having something that's more expressive than a taxonomy, that we have the ability to express these conditionals, not as procedures, not as in if-then in some Java code or C++ code or a stored procedure in an SAP script, but rather we have an ability to express them declaratively, have them chosen in the cases where they express and apply dynamically.
And those conditionals could actually be expressed in terms of an implementation then.
Yeah, just from an architectural perspective, a lot of, but not all of what we're talking about here is to deal with the actual data model of the architecture, the data model view of the architecture. So when you're looking at the whole architecture of how, you know, you talk to another company, you have a collaborative view of this where we agree we're going to do this, and then you have below that a process view, which is here's the business process and the sequence of events that happen in that. In those sequence of events, you have, you know, data being transferred from one place to another, instance data. The UBL, DCTS work, and to a large degree the UDEF work is largely focused on just the data model aspect of that whole question. So there is the implications of the business process that do affect what we're doing here, but we're not addressing it specifically in that work. So UBL has, for instance, the order process. They've defined the information models that slot into what that step of the order is. And that's kind of where we're coming from on it. I can't speak about the ontological because it has a lot more expanded notion of concept in it than just the core CCTS work.
And I would also echo what Duane just said, that the semantics of the payload is different than the syntax of the XML schema, which is where all your business rules for your process will show up.
So the fact that you want to allow for a single border to be associated to a given carrier's advance ship notice, that's again part of the schema, or to allow for multiple orders to be part of that.
It
doesn't have to be. But it's, those business rules are captured within the rules of the syntax and how and the order and what's mandatory and optional of your syntax of the schema. The content, the payload, is what the UDEF is tied to, and now I'm not going to speak to what the Ontolog forum is dealing with, but they can accommodate the different rules. In terms of verbs, the UDEF, you know, all verbs are types of, you know, processes, if you will. In other words, you know, there's action, you know, associated with processes. So, and one of the objects of the UDEF is process. So that's where you would find various verbs.
Yeah, let me just. I'm not 100% convinced that the problem you raised is a problem of semantic differences at all. I mean, you know, I may want to have order schemas built so that I can say, or shipping ASM schemas built so that I can say, this shipping notice actually covers several orders. But I'm not changing the meaning of order or notice, or none of those things change in meaning, right? You're gonna have that.
Very depending upon the content. But you can have different numbers of different elements depending upon the context.
Use that, man.
So it is a semantic. I think it's a syntax.
Yeah, we should.
Well, the syntax varies depending upon the context.
Before we go in, let's agree what we're all talking about with syntax first, but defer to the ontological expert first. Okay, so for me, syntax is a particular sequence of characters, okay? So there's an XML syntax, there's SQL syntax, there's, you know, at the bottom level, there's ASCII syntax. and these are issues of how we put characters together, and there's a relationship between syntax and semantics, often for particular languages that address semantics, but they are different things. So XML, for example, says absolutely nothing about semantics. It is only a standard for syntax. SQL says a little tiny bit about semantics because it does say, you know, includes, you know, this query language that actually pulls a little bit of meaning out of the statement. And something like first order logic, you know, there's a semantics for first order logic, for what it means to be there exists, or for all, or and, or not, or implied. Those are the standard elements of the first-order logical language. But there's, you know, a host of various syntax that first-order logic can appear in, including XML syntax. So I've you know, created an XML DTD that defines an XML rendering of first-order logic. But it's the logic that has the semantics, not the XML, which is the syntax. So forgive me for that tutorial.
I think she's saying
index XML schema doesn't address semantics either.
Right, but I think she's saying that the semantics of the document varies depending upon the context.
Yes.
So it can have different number of elements.
I buy into that.
A purchase order can mean different things in different contexts.
Yep.
I thought that's what Duane was getting at. And I thought there's synergy between what you're doing and what Duane is doing, because the rules for the context dependency can be specified.
Right, and I think
that's what Steve is referring
to. Yeah, and I think the problem, in fact, you're addressing is you've got both problems. I mean, there's a syntax or there's a sort of data arrangement problem that is, in some sense, incidental or accidental. And then there's probably some deep semantic issues between, you know, one SAP's implementation of an order reconciliation handling system and another, you know, rendering or implementation in SAP.
Right.
And the answer is yes, we do. But I think really we need to sit down with this group and work for a couple days.
I have to jump in and correct one thing for the record. I just to correct both what Adam said and what Duane said. It's not and it's not true that schema has no semantics. It's just semantics that's different from the kind we're all talking about here. XML does say this is an element, and that's
true.
An attribute, and this is a delimiter.
Right. So we've got a line on what we mean by semantics.
It's at a different level.
Well,
and that was actually the thing that got me to stand up, because I disagree slightly with Gary, you know, not like I heard of that before. But I would tend to categorize the changes in structure that you're talking about as still being syntax. This structure versus that structure, we're still talking about syntax.
Right.
What pattern of characters are we going to stick inside the document? Now,
right, this is Leo. I usually characterize the distinction between syntax and structure. Syntax is kind of like the string formation that Adam's talked about. Structure typically, so that's represented by the XML syntax, for example. But structure might be represented by XML schema, which is trying to characterize kind of aggregations of syntax, if you will. And it has nothing to do with meaning yet, but it tells you that within this column, there has to be a certain kind of thing which is characterized by a certain syntax. So structure you can view as an extension of syntax.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, and there are dependencies or ties over to semantics for any particular system, because often the, you know, these syntactic things aren't just totally arbitrary. They're there for a reason to actually tell you something. It's just that that semantics is often left implicit either in the standard or just, you know, up to the programmer and how he's actually defined how things are stored or presented.
Or somebody reads the implication into it by reading the element name.
Yeah.
And thinks, oh,
and
name,
language
I know what that is.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for a is there a mark? No.
For a computer, it's pretty easy with XML to, if I was to draw this on the screen, probably no one in this room knows what that means. You can't read it. XML at least puts it into a format like this, where you can say A-G-E-P. It's actually a Japanese kanji character. You still don't know what it means here, but you can read it. You can then look up through some other mechanism of semantics to determine it means fire. Were you right? Did you get that?
You see that on things on the street?
Yeah.
Let me steer this in a slightly. This discussion has been entirely too polite. I have here a question that I received in email when I sent out the notice that this thing was going to happen from a person who shall remain nameless but is fairly high up in world standards organizations, and he asks grumpily, if we have core components developed using the CCTS, why do we need UDEF?
Okay, UDEF is actually in my opinion, it's an implementation of an aspect of core component, which is a unique identifier. And UDEF does a very good job of correlating that unique identifier with something other than just it being a unique identifier. So core component has a unique identifier that we use for saying this is this one core component, and whatever register you find it in, you know it's the same core component. UDEF has a way of making that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ron, but making that unique identifier actually through a UDEF registry translate into something more than just a universal identifier. It actually can correlate or be reconciled with the qualifier terms and the actual class that it comes from.
Right. It's not just an identifier. It has internal structure,
it's
and the structure has meaning.
It's got intelligence within the ID.
But
and
how does that
reference from the ID?
How does that? What was
no,
the, I didn't hear the question.
It's like the difference of the unique identifier is like just reading a word. The UDEF is like reading the word plus the dictionary meaning of the word.
Oh.
Yeah. And I don't think any one of the things that you saw today are in itself a complete solution to the higher level problem, which is kind of what you were asking. I think that all of this is, you know, relating. It's complementary in that it's a piece of this problem. So we didn't get as ugly as the question.
I think what the questioner was, let me rephrase that simple question and read his mind. I think what he was saying is in a core components defined term, it's a 3-part 11179 term that looks like a very verbose version, but
more mnemonic version of what UDEF does with its three-part term. So that's the comparison I would make, not with IDs. It seems to me that we're talking about the dictionary entry name and just different ways of expressing it. Is that right? Or is there something more going on there?
You can take all of what's in core component and map them all into the UDEF and give them all UDEF IDs. But the UDEF, by its very nature, can go far beyond what core components will ever get to. For example, and I'll be talking about this tomorrow, the entire Department of Defense warfighter deals with things such as getting a weapon on a target by a certain time. And all of the concepts associated with that domain are things that I suspect will never show up in a core component slide.
Why? What would prevent that? What limitation of core components would prevent this?
A lot of that stuff is classified. Now, I'm not saying that it couldn't, but I'm saying that it would not normally show up in an international core components library. And so there are concepts of information that need to be shared between different systems, different applications that the UDEF can accommodate. And I'm not saying that the other, that core components couldn't, but it's simply the nature of what is happening in core components being an international standard. You would not probably expect those kinds of elements to show up.
Well, that doesn't sound like a difference in mechanical ability to comprehend a certain problem space. It sounds like a difference in the intention of the people who happen to be using these two things.
I would concur with that.
Right.
The pattern for both of those things is the same, whether it's a U.S. fighter jet firing a missile that's supposed to arrive at a certain time space coordinate versus a manufacturer sending something that has to arrive at a certain time coordinate. To me, that's kind of the same base pattern.
The pattern is the same, but the terminology that ends up getting used will be somewhat different.
And a great example of why terminology needs to get separated from content.
And they have Canadians working on core components, so that will never be U.S. military.
But just to clarify something, both of them are extensible.
Both are extensible.
Can I correct you on core components? Core components, the extension, the set of core components is extensible based on doing your ontology kind of work first to figure out if you should extend it or simply repurpose an existing thing. The relationship between core components and BIEs is not one of extension, it's one of constraints. So you can, at the BIE, like that would be represented by something like UBL, data element, is further specialized and constrained. You can't add more things to it and open it up further. And that's largely to deal with the realities of system processing, how applications
are. Are you saying that there is difference between the UDEF core components?
Core components, as far as I know, is not based on any kind of ontology foundation.
Well, I think that's what these guys are attempting to put in place.
Right?
You can definitely use multiple ontology methodologies with it, but nobody's up until now has really taken the time to really start. That's a lot of work. I mean, you have to appreciate the enormous complexity that could be present. Imagine if you only had 18 base core component types and you had 8 context categories and combinations of those, and each of those had, say, maybe only 100 different enumerated lists. If you take that and look at 100 to the power of 8 for each one of those 18 core components, you're dealing with a huge chunk of information. And then the relationships between all of those, this is derived from this only in this specific set of contextual circumstances, it's kind of not surprising that the work hasn't been done yet.
You know, one thing I really like about the CCT, though, is that they really have, it seems to me, made an effort
to be general and minimal and not add things kind of willy-nilly, which I think is a real problem in any kind of, you know, it's both a problem with formal ontology as well as any other standard where people say, you know, there's a problem with people not going into doing that real deep level analysis, especially with regards to that three-part diagram of ontology versus language versus knowledge, where especially people say, you know, I have two different words for the same thing. They must just be different concepts. Let's put them both in the standard without doing the deeper analysis that actually finds out there's really a third concept that is the unifier of the two of them. These are minor specializations of them. And that is the kind of, I think, beauty of what at least was intended with CCP and what we're trying to stick with the same spirit in doing SUMO and doing the CCP mapping to SUMO, not creating new things unless we've done the deep analysis to realize that that new concept absolutely deserves its right to be included in its distinct and its expressible explicitly how it's distinct from all of the other terms that already exist.
I'll give you examples of this in theory of two different groups doing the same thing and one taking a more pragmatic approach to doing that hard analysis of stuff. The SIPS and IJI data dictionary has 353 data elements. Of those, you probably could argue that they all map roughly to those top 20 representation types. The U.S. Department of Justice has one with almost 5,000 data elements. And a lot of those are the same four qualifiers terms, but with a fifth qualifier that's only marginally different at the front. And when you get, you know, with anything, when you get to over a couple hundred of these, you end up to the point where it becomes largely difficult to manage just by the sheer number you're looking at. And if you don't have them organized into some sort of structured hierarchy and have agreed upon the methodology for how you stuff things in those different levels of the hierarchy and the rules that constrain that, so two people doing the same thing arrive at the same conclusion, it's not going to be easy to do the work. And that's what I think the benefit of that. Kind of
so, I mean, SUMO is one ontological system, right? I mean, there's other systems. Now, there you can create matching between one system to another. So, theoretically speaking, there's only one true ontological system. I mean, should cover the whole, you know, reality. Probably deep in some reality, so there should be only one ontological.
Well, one thing I like to, you know, sir, this is a terrible argument, okay? But let me rephrase that. This is a difficult argument because people want to say, you know, my worldview is actually different. I think on some level you're absolutely right that there is sort of one, you know, true ontology somewhere, but we're not really going to find out what it is. And what I like to say is that SUMO is sort of one of many true upper ontologies that could be created. Okay, there are others. There are others. Several groups are doing different ontologies. They're all sufficient because at the high level, we're talking about metaphysics. We're talking about things philosophers have argued over for thousands of years without conclusion. Now, we have to be sure we don't repeat mistakes that were then solved later in philosophy. But there's no hard and fast grounding, for example, on whether entities have identity over time or whether there's no such thing as change and there's merely relations between temporal slices of things over time. This is the classic 2D versus the 4D argument. I'm happy to go through all the painful details of that offline, but just suffice to say this is an argument that's still going on in metaphysics. It will probably go on for the next 100, if not 1,000 years. There's no right answer to it. There's merely an internally self-consistent model, just in the same way that, you know, particle physics is modeling things for, I think, which will ultimately decide there's no objective reality. There are merely our self-consistent models that have predictive power, and that's what we're after, something that has utility. It has predictive power, and no one's saying that, you know, I'm not saying that SUMO is the one true model, and all the terms that I have are an objective reflection of reality. They are a model that has predictive power.
Right, but to ratchet that down several levels, but arrive at a similar problem. It only recently came up in UBL discussions, in discussions about what does CCTS conformance mean, that we had to say, well, something can be perfectly CCTS conformant and yet, at the end of the day, result in a set of core components that is not the same as a set of core components that's being standardized, say, in CFAC. So it's entirely possible you have a totally CCTS compliant standard whose core components bore only, you know, very little resemblance to the core components that you're going to get out of a different effort that thinks it's analyzing the same problem state.
The context right. of which you do the work.
Yeah, but it reminds me on a different level of the point Adam was making. In other words, we don't know. I mean, the quest for the one true semantic registry, if you back away far enough from it, doesn't look that different from the quest of the one true upper ontology. Right? The one's a lot more complex and is taking place at a different level. But
and pragmatically, I would suggest we probably won't get there in our lifetime because we can't even agree on what side of the road to drive on, what the plug, what the electrical outlet in a wall should look like, or what the phone jack should
look
like.
Not
a
difference
like.
In concept.
Yeah.
Can I just bring up you brought up an
issue for a second, otherwise the point will make sense. The other thing I think from the whole idea of business standardization and communication is that there are kind of two things that are going on when we define the semantics richly and explicitly, one of which I'm not quite convinced of yet, because it goes back to John, your have the system tell me where the perfect hamburger is analogy, and that is the ability for the system to go in and axiomatically look, take a look at all these rules, do the inference, and come up with conclusions. That's a type of behavior I'm not quite convinced we're going to see a lot of value out of short term, except in very isolated systems and applications. The other thing that's going on, however, is that having these incredibly precise definitions allow us to be confident that this concept and this concept are different, and the terms we apply to them are, we can make sure they're distinct and we don't stomp all over each other. So it's for those of us who interact with the model to know that we're really dealing with something fairly concrete that's distinct from something else, and those definitions allow us to make those determinations with some level of reliability. Now, if we can go to the next step, and those definitions are truthful in the big world sense, and the machines can now make reasonable inferences about things and drive conclusions we might not have been able to do otherwise or faster or whatever. That's an additional set of benefits, but it's an entirely different behavioral space.
Who was that just talking?
That was Kurt Conrad.
Ah, okay.
So just, Duane, you just brought, I think, alluded to a really interesting issue, which is about maintenance of standards. And so I look at, you know, the DoD data model, which is something defined in IDAP, and it's just, you know, enormous and has just tremendous redundancy. And why does it have redundancy? It has redundancy because everybody was supposed to put their stuff into this data model, but it was really hard to find where to connect it. So they just threw things in, and there was no way to have an automated process to determine whether that thing was contradictory or redundant. As I think the standards community moves to a greater degree of formalization, of computability in the standards, so standards that are not defined on the basis of language, but standards that are defined on the basis of logic, then we'll have the ability, at least in theory, to prove whether my new concept with its associated axiom actually extends the model or is just redundant or is just contradictory. We have the ability to give some of this terrible maintenance problem to the machines and have them do it automatically, as opposed to having a person reading pages and pages of the dictionary and saying, well, you know, your English definition is kind of like this English definition, therefore I think these two things should be merged.
I would ditto and say, yay, verily, and suggest to you that that's, in essence, what the UDEF registry would do as well.
Well, but the assignment both in both UDEF and CCTS, and both UDEF and core components are similar in this respect, and very different from what I'm hearing about ontologies, okay, is that they are, even though they have this classification system in both cases, this 11179-derived classification system, what you get out of it at the end of the exercise are the fruits of human beings sitting down and saying, you know, this really is the same thing as that, okay, or this falls into this category, whereas presumably what I could get, I mean, some of that goes on at certain reaches of the ontology, but I could get new statements that didn't rely upon human judgment that this is in a certain relationship to that.
I mean,
based on the rules that are baked into these things.
Let me elaborate on that a second. Part of what CCTS does deliver is that the first part of the work, as you know, you were there, was the methodology for how you analyze those things and make those decisions. And that could be instantiated by humans, or it could be instantiated by applications eventually if you had enough machine processable artifacts to have support that process. But for now, it's largely a human process where, you know, and the value of CCTS, I don't think, is truly the output or what potential output could be if they went and did output right now, but it's really the thinking that went into that process that enabled people like the UBL group to come along and actually apply that and derive at that output. Because if that process is reused, hopefully the next people who come along will be guided towards the same kind of methodology.
Well, yes, but in just to be clear about this, that is not actually what's happening. It's happening the other way around. What's actually happening is that people do all this definition and then they say, oh, can we abstract out of here some core components?
In theory, right? If it happens.
In theory, that's
right. That would be the third part of what Adam said to you. It'd be nice to define standards. And the other thing is that I would add is without politics. That
I
can't promise a solution to that.
I think the point here, this is Steve Ray again, is that the point of ontologies is when you can axiomatize them, you boil them down to a fairly small number of axioms. And what an axiom is an act of faith, right? I mean, you just have to take that definition on faith. And those are the things, presumably, these definitions are definitions that are virtually impossible to misunderstand. And that's where I was getting at with some of these other definitions, which are much higher level. They're still very possible to misunderstand. But I think if you can axiomatize the definitions, then you can stick to a fairly, you know, atomic definitions, and then you can build on those to determine what's different and what's the same.
Steve, while you're on the phone, Steve is the chief from NIST on manufacturing system integration. I think if you can give us a rendering of your semantic distance approach to standards, I mean, that might illuminate the subject, especially answer one of the questions that an earlier person asked about where's the big picture, where do we stand? I mean,
yeah, actually, semantic distance is a big unanswered issue right now. We don't really have a good way of measuring semantic distance. All we can say with logic is that something is either equal or not equal, or consistent or inconsistent. But what we have been trying to struggle with is how would one go about quantifying how far apart two definitions are from each other, semantic concepts. That's a huge question. We had a workshop on it. We're still trying to struggle with what even branch of mathematics could even lend to that. But I think that's still a deep research issue, which is not going to see the light of sort of practical application for many years to come, I think.
Actually, Steve, we did some of that in the HPKV project.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm not claiming in any sense that we have the answer, but we did have a measure for semantic distance, and with a large formal ontology, it's fairly easy to come up with several.
Huh, I'd love to talk to you more about that.
Yeah, definitely, let's do that.
Even within the CCTS, and the UDEF would support this, there is a you could look at the number of alignment of qualifier terms versus the disalignment and come up with some rudimentary, you know, applied.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I
think there are symptomatic correlations. You could talk about, you know, jumps in WordNet, you know, how far away you are or something.
Right.
But ultimately, we're trying to find, we're trying to pursue, this is a personal passion of mine, which is, I think we need to approach this whole field like an engineer who's designing a bridge. And if we're trying to design a model, an ontology, whatever, we need to use, you know, proven principles. We need to have quantifiable and measurable units to help us understand if something's correct. That's why I like the first-order logic approach, because you can prove consistency. It's not an opinion anymore. It's this model is self-consistent or it isn't, because you can run a theorem prover over it and uncover the inconsistencies. And I think it's building blocks like that, you know, robust, provably complete, axiomatized ontologies that are going to be the building blocks that we build much more elaborate constructs out of down the road. And for ever, basically, since IT was invented, we've been doing this kind of top-down because that's all we have. We don't have a science of meaning that is operationalized yet to build these automated systems. So we have to do, you know, data modeling with opinions as to what a thing means, and we rely upon the internalization of that in our own minds to carry us through the sort of the leaps of faith that we have to make right now. So this is a long-term effort, though. We have to sort of go back to first principles, I think, treat the building of these systems like an engineering discipline, and then we'll have predictability, you know, predictable behavior of these systems, as opposed to software that one builds and ends up with, bugs, which we then fix after the fact because, you know, we don't anticipate them ahead of time. And the analogies, you know, there are many analogies, civil engineering, whatever. You don't build a bridge and then sort of see if it holds the truck and then fix it if it doesn't. You can predict how much load the bridge is going to support because we have an underlying science of stress and failure analysis and things like that.
I would assert.
I would love to follow up on that myself. I think some of us are just getting warmed up.
Yeah.
but we have hit the time that we scheduled for this. So thank you all. This is lovely. Perhaps we can schedule something similar again and continue this discussion. I think it is. I think in EIDX, we're talking about a field of application that really does practically need answers to these questions. These are not theoretical to us.
Yeah.
As was brought up by some of the questions here, the idea of how much distance there is semantically between what appear to be related or similar concepts is a critical question, especially in our field when we get into the legal implications of what's being said. And then we need to know, did what you say over here mean the same thing as what I thought you meant?
Yeah. Okay.
So on that note, I thank our panelists and our participants. Peter, you were saying that this has been recorded and will be available. Is that right? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
All right. I actually set up a wiki page on the Ontolog forum space. That people, remote callers, probably had already accessed that page to get the numbers and download the slides. But whoever is interested can go to that page. We have recorded this, so maybe by tonight I'll be able to upload an MP3 file of the recording of this session. It's also available telephone replay but over the next 10 days in case you want to hear this over again. There's a number you can dial to play this back.
Okay, great. The next EIDX meeting is going to be in Houston in April. I don't have those dates right in front of me, but maybe we can maybe you can consider offline whether you folks might be available to continue this discussion.
I mean,
sure.
Up to. And,
sure.
And for those who are interested in the discussion, this is ongoing. Our URL is ontolog.dim3.net. Come join us.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, all.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you. The host has disconnected. The conference...